Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Today's two interviews give the show a theme: energy, climate change, and the economy. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Robin Mills, an oil industry geologist and author of a new book, who will tell us why the peak oilers are wrong and we're not running out of this stuff. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Bracken Hendricks of the Center for American Progress on how a green energy investment program could create lots of good jobs and save the planet at the same time. Before all that, a few words in the economic news. On Friday, the price of oil dipped below $100 a barrel for the first time since April. That's still a very high price, but it's also $45 below the peak set last July. There are several things at work here: a general economic slowdown, particularly in the U.S., Europe, and Japan, not yet China so much, changes in behavior inspired by high prices, and the exit of speculators from the market. The decline in gasoline use in the U.S. has been quite extraordinary. Preliminary numbers for early September are down about 9% from a year ago. That's only a little behind the record decline set in 1980 during the oil shock that came after the Iranian Revolution, when gasoline use fell by more than 11% over the year. A lot of pundits said this wouldn't happen, but it has. Any reduction in gasoline use is good news for the climate, but it's not without problems. High gas prices have caused a lot of people financial pain. The weakness of the economy only worsens that pain. It's looking more and more like people are cutting back on discretionary items and spending what cash they have just on essentials. Even luxury retailers are reporting weak results, though that's probably less the result of hardship among the rich than it is the result of a decline in what's called aspirational shopping, in which the near-rich spend beyond their means. And everyone else seems to be trading down. The retailers reporting the best results lately are discounters like Walmart. And history suggests that if gas prices do come down, and they should, with the price of crude down so sharply, people will start driving more again, and pretty soon. Relying on the market to make energy policy isn't only unjust, it's unreliable. Anyway, much more on oil and other sources of energy to follow soon. In a report released on Thursday, the UN disclosed that while extreme poverty, defined as an income equal to $1.25 a day or less, has declined in Asia, particularly in China, since 1980, other parts of the world have been less fortunate. In fact, the number of Africans living in extreme poverty has increased by 100 million over the last 25 years. Average daily consumption on that continent, according to the UN, is the equivalent of 70 U.S. cents a day. And in rich countries, especially the U.S., are doing next to nothing to alleviate the distress. Finally, this McCain-Palin surge in the polls is driving me nuts. As I've said here many times, I am not a major fan of the Democrats, and Obama fever completely passed me by. But the ease with which so many Americans have fallen for the cretinous Republican campaign is sending me into despair. It's nothing but caricatures and slurs. Some idiot on CNN said the other night that Americans are getting to know Sarah Palin and are coming around to liking her. What in God's name does this mean? She gave one tightly scripted speech and a single TV interview in which she clearly had no idea what she was talking about. What's to know and like about that? Oh, right, I almost forgot. A lot of Americans identify with people who have no idea what they're talking about and resent the smarty pants who do. Who needs to define the Bush Doctrine when all that matters is if you're right with Jesus? With that in mind, let's take this non-musical break.
Stained glass windows keep the cold outside, while the hypocrites hide inside with the lies of statues in their minds, where the Christian religion made them blind, where they hide and pray to the god of a bitch spelt backwards is dog, not for one race, one creed, one world, but for money, effective, absurd. Do you give away the cash you can't afford on bended knees and pray to the Lord? Fat pig priest, sanctimonious smiles. He takes the money, you take the lies. This is religion and Jesus Christ. This is religion cheaply priced. This is Bibles full of libel. This is sin in eternal hymn. This is what they've done. This is your religion. The apostles were 11. Now there's a sod in heaven. This is religion. There's a liar on the altar. The sermon never falter. This is religion. Your religion.
That was a slightly edited version of Religion 1 by Public Image Limited. Crude, I know, but the Palin-inspired resurrection of the Fundies has sent me to it. Bibles full of libel, as the man said. I know there are many fine people who are also religious, but I can't stand to see all the debased ones so visibly on display. Onward. My first guest is Robin Mills, author of The Myth of the Oil Crisis, Overcoming the Challenges of Depletion, Geopolitics, and Global Warming, just out from Prager. I first learned of Mills' work when he wrote a guest column on Juan Cole's blog, and immediately wanted to interview him because I'm deeply skeptical of peak oil theories, and I was excited to find someone who not only could debunk them knowledgeably, but do so while not being a nutty climate change denialist. I've long suspected that a lot of the enthusiasm for peak oil theories is driven more by desire than analysis. People want the oil age to end because it's so environmentally destructive, and because the automobile can be so aesthetically and socially destructive, too. So they make a giant leap to concluding that the wells are running dry. But they're not. The greater danger is that we'll wreck the Earth by burning the 42 years' worth of oil we do have, instead of making the necessary political, economic, and technical decisions to move beyond oil. It does seem like a massive leap to do that. There are too many interests invested in the status quo. Thus, the appeal of short-circuiting those vested interests by positing an inevitable decline in oil production. The price spike of the last couple of years has lent a lot of support to peak oil theory, since it looked like the market was offering support to the scarcity scenarios. The high price also lent some urgency to the need to conserve oil and to move to cleaner energy sources. With oil price now 30% off its mid-July peak, that urgency will weaken, and if the price falls further, as is likely, there may be a return to complacency. But we have to be honest about this. The world is not running out of oil and won't anytime soon. Whenever I say this, I get hostile emails, and I suspect today will be no exception. There's an almost religious belief in peak oil, and adherents might not be swayed by rational arguments like those of Robin Mills. But for those of you whose minds are open, Mills is well worth listening to. Oh, and I caught up with Mills via cell phone in Dubai, so his voice breaks up every now and then, as is likely with cell phones. But the signal is still a lot better than your typical American cell phone. We can be such a technological backwater sometimes. Robin Mills. Welcome to Behind the News, Robin Mills. There's a long history to forecasts of the end of oil, isn't there?
Well, that's right. And, you know, ever since 1880 or something, there have been people saying that we're running out of oil. Fears that, you know, back in the 1880s that the U.S. was running out of oil. Fears after the First World War, again, that the U.S. was going to run out of gasoline. Then there were the same kind of warnings that we were running out of oil in the 40s and the 50s, and that was when the famous geologist M.K. Hubbard came along and did a lot of work on the subject and forecast that U.S. production was going to fall shortly, and that would be followed by a fall in worldwide production. Then, of course, in the 70s with the oil crises, there were fears, and Jimmy Carter spoke on the subject that oil production was falling around the world. And now prices are high again, and the same fears come back.
Of course, prices aren't as high as they were a few months ago. What do you make of the recent decline?
Well, I think it's interesting, and it's really an illustration of the kind of the factors that drive why we're not running out of oil. On the one hand, some new suppliers coming along, and Saudi Arabia recently opened a new facility with a big production capacity. And I think probably more importantly for the recent fall, we see that when prices are high, then people more efficiently, they drive less, they drive smaller cars, they find ways to save oil, and that's been a big factor in the recent fall, that particularly oil demand in Europe and in America has fallen. And of course that's partly due to the economy slowing down, but it's also partly due to people using oil more efficiently.
In the book you identify several different approaches to the issue of measuring reserves, the geologic, the economic. Could you review those for us?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think in this whole subject when we're talking about oil, is oil running out and so on, there are a number of kind of schools of thought. And I've tried to just give these some labels to make it easier to distinguish them. And on the one hand, I put the geologists, and on the other hand, I have really the economists. Now, the geologists are the people who say, well, you know, you have to have oil in the ground before you can produce it. Oil in the ground is determined by geology. Mother Nature only puts so much oil in the ground, and once that's gone, it's gone. So, therefore, at some point, we're going to run out of oil. Now, the economists take a different view on this. They say, yeah, you know, sure, okay, in theory, the amount of oil in the ground is limited. in practice, it's so big that it hardly matters how much ore there is in the ground. What matters is how much we can get and at what price. And they say that when prices are high, then that creates incentives for people to bring on stream new fields, to find new technologies, to use oil more efficiently, and so in the end prices come down again, as we've seen, you know, many times throughout history that prices have risen and fallen.
Just what is your experience in the industry?
Well, I worked for, I've been in the oil industry for many years, and I worked for Shell for over 10 years, and I've now been working in the Middle East for several years for a number of oil companies. I started out as a geologist, and I guess I mean geologist not in the sense that I just use it, I mean, you know, geologist in the real sense of the guy who goes out and studies the rocks. But more recently I've moved into economics, so looking at the economic viability of projects.
I think many of the people in the listening audience are adherents of peak oil theory, and the patron saint of that theory is M. King Hubbert. Who was he, and what exactly did he say?
Well, M. King Hubbert was a Shell geologist originally, and I suppose and since kind of an old colleague of mine. And he was a geologist who, from the 1950s onwards, worked on the subject of oil, production of oil, and limits to production. And he started off by looking at the United States and production. At that point, there were some very high predictions for how high American production would eventually go. And he said that no, production wouldn't go that high, that it would be limited by the fundamental supply of oil in the ground in the United States. And he predicted that U.S. production would peak somewhere between 1965 and 1970 and then fall off. Now, as eventually happened, U.S. production started falling after 1970. And so a lot of people have taken this to prove that, yeah, Hubbert's methods were correct and that he had a good method for predicting oil production. Now, Hubbert went on from this to try and repeat the same thing for world oil production, and there he peaked at around 2000. Now, it's 2008 now. Okay, production still rising, has risen considerably since 2000. But still, the adherents of Hubbert say, well, he was still basically correct, and the peak, you know, is around, using his methods, is around now. And he'd derived a method, so-called Hubbert's curve, which is basically a curve on a graph which you can use by looking at historical production. You can try and get an idea for future production from this.
Hubbert's application of his curve to the U.S. was right, but is about the only time it worked. Isn't that right?
Right, and Hubbert applied his same methods to, as I said, to the world, where he predicted a peak years ago, which we haven't seen yet. He also predicted a U.S. peak in natural gas production, which was very far below the actual peak reached in U.S. natural gas production. And followers of Hubbert have tried to use his method on many countries, on some 70 or 80 major oil-producing countries around the world, and in only a very few cases did his method give anything like an accurate prediction.
Where did he go wrong?
I think there are a number of flaws with the method, and the biggest one is it's more of a data-fitting exercise. There's nothing of the fundamentals behind it that drive supply in terms of there's really only a single variable, the amount of oil that can be recovered. There's no impact of technology, of oil prices going up and down, of geopolitical factors that affect oil supply. And of these, you know, really the technology aspect is shown one of the biggest ones, that the Hubbert curve doesn't allow for technology to advance and for new oil supplies to, new methods of extracting oil to be developed. And in fact, when it's been applied to some specific areas of the U.S., it can be shown that it's fallen down exactly because technology added reserves in those areas that couldn't have been dreamt of at the time that the prediction was done.
During the years when the price of oil was very low, there were cutbacks in investment, a lot of people didn't go into oil-related careers, which leaves us with a great shortage now of human and physical resources. How much of a problem is that for ramping up exploration now?
That's been a very serious issue. I think that is really the prime underlying cause for the very sharp run-up in prices that we've seen since the late 90s, and that's both on the demand and on the supply side. I mean, really from 1986 onwards, we had an unusually low period of oil prices that culminated in 98 when the oil price was around $10 a barrel. And at $10 a barrel, oil was just so cheap that it creates an incentive for everybody to go out and buy SUVs and, you know, drive these big cars, and for consumption to explode in the developing world, in India and China and so on. And on the other hand, there's no way that at $10 a barrel, the big oil producers, the oil companies and the big oil exporting nations like Russia and Saudi Arabia could increase their production and keep up investment in their fields. And the oil business is really a business with very long lead times. And to explore a new area, to discover oil and to bring that oil on stream is a matter of minimum 5 years, easily 10 years. And if you look at Kashagan, which is a very large field in Kazakhstan, discovered almost 10 years ago now, that field is now predicted to come on stream in about 2014. Now, that's maybe a uniquely long-lived example, but I mean, it points to the time that it takes to kind of turn this supertanker around. When prices rise, it takes such a long time for the industry to gear up to that factor, to train new geologists, to get new drilling rigs, to get all the kind of equipment and so on that's needed. And in the middle of all of this, we had a global economic boom as well, which meant the price of steel and all kind of other inputs was going up very sharply as well. And all these things combined make it very difficult for the oil business to increase production even as prices were rising. And I think now we are beginning to see, for example, with some of these discoveries in deep water in Brazil, we are beginning to see that the industry is getting on top of the problem, and we can kind of see some light at the end of the tunnel in terms of getting some new supplies.
I saw a quote from a Goldman Sachs analyst recently who said that we're not facing geological peak oil, but political peak oil. What do you think of that?
Well, I know I've talked to some of the Goldman guys on their predictions, and so far I think they've predicted high prices and been proved right and have some good reasons for that. I mean, I certainly agree with them that the problem is not geological peak oil, and I agree with them that a lot of the problem today is in terms of getting investment into some of the big oil regions, that if it had been easier to invest in some big oil-producing countries, then we would have seen production rise earlier than it has. And take Venezuela, for example. Venezuelan production is down heavily as from a few years back, and that's in large part due to the policies of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela in terms of discouraging foreign investment. And that's kind of an extreme example, but obviously it's also been difficult to invest in recent years in countries like Nigeria and Iraq and so on, which also have big potential. So I think there are a lot of factors that are dragging on investment and new supplies around the world, not geopolitical factors, but I don't think those factors are going to persist indefinitely, not in every country at least.
I'm speaking with Robin Mills, author of The Myth of Peak Oil, just out from Prager. A couple of years ago, I interviewed an analyst from PFC Energy and asked him what was behind the low level of exploration activity, whether it was Wall Street shareholders demanding returns to stockholders rather than spending money on exploration, or what was behind the relatively low level of drilling activity. And his answer was that it was a matter of having run out of regions to explore. Do you think he was right?
Yes, I'm not sure that's true. I mean, I think in the short term there's some truth to it, in that some of the very promising oil regions of the 90s, such as the North Sea, have probably passed their peak in terms of production, and so the new fields that are found there are smaller and more expensive. I think there's some truth in that. I think, though, that the evidence of recent years shows that there are actually still some pretty promising areas out there, and deep water Brazil, as I mentioned earlier, has been the real shining light there, the real surprise, with some gigantic fields that I don't think anybody expected to find there. And that's a tough environment, an expensive environment to be operating, and that's why people have only managed to get out there and explore recently with the high prices and new technology. And I think there are other challenging parts of the world, for instance the Arctic, which are also very promising for new finds. So I think there are new frontiers out there. I think, though, a lot of it comes down to needing a sustained period of high prices to give the incentive for the industry to get into these places and develop the technologies they need to operate there.
A number of analysts, most prominently Matthew Simmons, say that Saudi Arabia is running low on oil. Business Week recently published a memo purportedly from someone in the inside of the Saudi oil industry saying their fuels were aging and running low. How much should we worry about Saudi Arabia running out of oil?
Personally, I don't think so. At least Saudi Arabia is not one of the first places I would worry about in terms of oil supply. Of course, Saudi Arabia says it's not a bottomless pit. You know, every country has limits to how much oil it can produce ultimately. But Saudi Arabia, over many years, has shown its capacity to pump a lot of oil, do that very consistently, and also supply markets when they're most needed. And again, I mentioned earlier, Saudi Arabia just a few days ago brought on stream a new production facility. And there are other fields that are now in the big Saudi fields are now in development. And these are big fields that would have been developed decades ago pretty much anywhere else in the world. The Saudis only now have felt the need to to bring these fields in on stream. And I think if you look at the amount of the intensity of investment in Saudi Arabia and the intensity of activity, it's still pretty low in terms of the amount of exploration wells drilled and in terms of the amount of wells being drilled on the mature fields compared to other places in the world. I think Saudi Arabia is still at a relatively early stage of its oil life.
What about Iraq? Sanctions and war took a toll on production. What are the possibilities for ramping up production there?
I think just purely on geological side, Iraq is probably the most promising country in the whole world for new oil suppliers. Huge exploration potential, many discovered and undeveloped fields. I have 90-odd fields, of which only two really have ever produced really significant volumes. Some supergiant fields that have never been developed or barely developed. So I think Iraq's potential is huge. Now, we've seen this, as far as we can tell, the security situation has improved recently over the last year or so, and that we just had a deal for the Chinese to develop a medium-sized oil field there. So maybe we're reaching the stage where security-wise it's possible to get more investment and development into Iraq. And that remains to be seen. But yes, purely geologically, Iraq's potential is huge.
So far we've been talking about supplies, but what are the possibilities for reducing demand?
I think a very, very large potential there, and I think this is something that's underestimated. A lot of peak oil supporters say, well, okay, let's say if oil production is going to peak and then decline, then we're all going to run out of energy, the lights are going to go off, and civilization is in danger of collapsing. And I don't buy that at all. If we look back at other periods of history, if we look back at the early 80s oil shock, for example, then after the initial oil shock and there was a recession after that, although oil prices remained very high, the U.S. economy, for example, grew quite strongly. It showed that it is possible to have economic growth even in the face of flat or declining oil supplies. And we can point to a lot of technologies. Particularly, you know, the primary use of oil, of course, is for transport. It's for gasoline and diesel and jet fuel. And we can see a lot of technologies on the horizon, particularly for automobiles, hybrid cars and so on. And now we're talking about plug-in hybrids, which, you know, actually take electricity off the grid to charge a battery. Maybe further down the line, we could look at hydrogen cars, although I think that's still some way off. And then lots of really very simple changes in automobiles that make them more efficient, having smaller and lighter cars, making more use of public transport as we have in Europe and Japan. So I think the scope for efficiency, even at the same time as keeping economic growth going, is very large.
Back to the supply side, what about so-called unconventional sources, things like oil shale and tar sands?
You're absolutely right to mention this. I mean, this is really, for me, is probably the key reason why I think we have oil, plenty of oil to keep production going for many decades to come, rather than conventional oil. You know, I can kind of say the argument, you can argue about conventional oil and, you know, maybe some countries' reserves are, you know, arguably overstated and maybe there isn't enough conventional oil to grow production over the very long periods. But if you look at unconventional oil, the supply is enormous. And we're looking here at a number of different sources of unconventional oil. We're talking about heavy, extra heavy oils. It's very thick. Viscous oil that's very hard to extract. Huge deposits of that in Canada, the famous oil sands in Alberta, which are now being developed very actively, also in Venezuela. And there are a lot of deposits of these that are less well known around the world, in Russia, in Madagascar, in Congo. Many, many of these deposits that have barely been looked at. So that's one major source. And then there are other kinds of unconventional oil. We may hear talk about oil shales, which are also very common in the American Midwest. They have some technical challenges, but I think there are now at least a couple of companies who think they've cracked the challenges of oil shales, of getting oil out of these rocks. And then, of course, you have biofuels, and biofuels have taken a bad rap recently on driving up food prices and land use and maybe some problems with environmental effects. But still, the potential for biofuels, again, as Brazil's shown, the right kind of biofuels in the right climate and with the right technologies is another large potential source of supply.
What level of oil prices do we need to make these unconventional sources economically rational?
When we were looking back in the late 90s at unconventional oil supplies, the break-even prices that we talked about were surprisingly low. I mean, we're talking for some of these heavy oil developments, break-even prices of $20 to $30 a barrel. Now, that's probably gone up since because of the shortage of materials and the competition for projects. And now we have, depending on the biofuel kind of thing, I think 50 to 60 is reasonable for these projects. And I think certainly the break-even price of these projects is well below where oil prices are today.
We haven't yet talked about the environmental issues, but they're obviously crucial. First, is there a way to extract these unconventional supplies without doing great damage?
I think that, you know, that is one of the big concerns for these unconventional oil suppliers. It depends very much what kind of unconventional oil you're talking about as to exactly what the environmental impacts are. You know, if you talk about the Canadian oil sands, there are local physical impacts to do with mining that affect the environment. Of course, a large area of land has to be dug up. There's a lot of use of water and so on. And these are serious issues, although local ones. I think industry practice there is improving, but has some way to go, and we need some very sensible and targeted regulation of those kind of developments to keep the improvement going there. And then I think on the other side, a lot of these unconventional oil projects are very carbon intensive and produce a lot of carbon dioxide, and then obviously have a big potential for contributing to climate change. That's probably the bigger issue. Now, some unconventional oil suppliers like biofuels, I think, arguably don't have this carbon impact, but others like oil sands and some methods for making oil from coal and so on do. And I think a key technology that fits in there is the technology of carbon capture, which is one I discuss at some length. And that's taking the carbon dioxide that industrial processes is produced before it ever gets into the atmosphere and storing it underground, and so locking it away indefinitely, so it never gets into the air and contributes to climate change. And that's a technology of a number of pilot projects going around in the world now. There's some pilot projects, for example, in Norway, and there's Algeria. There's some others proposed in Australia and the US. And I think all the technological pieces of carbon capture are there. They just need to be brought together and implemented on a large scale. And I think this is technology that really has a key part in helping the fossil fuel industry play its part in fighting climate change.
We should make this clear. You're not a denialist about climate change. You believe it's real and it's caused by human actions, right?
No, absolutely. I believe climate change is real, and I believe that human activities are the main contributors to that. You know, I'm not an expert. I'm not a climate scientist in this, but going from the consensus of scientists, it seems very clear to me that the climate change is human-caused. Climate change is a real thing.
Back to carbon sequestration. I've heard economists say that this is all pretty much pie in the sky at this point. There are enormous quantities to be disposed of. The technology doesn't exist. The potential costs are huge. You're more optimistic than that, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm very optimistic, and that's partly because in my career, I actually worked on a couple of these carbon capture projects, and so I got to see a little bit of the inside of what's required. I mean, I think in terms of the technology, it's all, to be honest, it's pretty much all proven technology. Yeah, it needs advances, it needs to reduce costs and so on, but can it be technically done? It can be. There's pretty much no question about that. And in fact, the oil industry has been putting carbon dioxide into the ground in West Texas for decades, and they do that actually to recover more oil, not for climate change reasons, but it's the same process. They've shown it can be done. And the storage space, if you calculate how much underground storage space there is, also vast amounts available in most big industrial regions. And we're talking about doing it on a huge scale. Yeah, that's the issue, I think, of putting the different bits of this technology together and getting them to work in a sensible commercial and legal framework so that there's actually the right incentives for people to do this. It's got to be done on a huge scale to tackle climate change, but then anything that's done to tackle climate change has to be done on a huge scale, whether you're talking about solar power or wind power or biofuels or anything else. You know, because climate change is such a big problem, we're talking about really the whole of the industrial economy has to change. So all these solutions are going to be big, and I think carbon capture can play its big part in that.
So to sum it all up, you'd say that the energy and climate challenges are real and serious, but not terminal crises, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I think we already have a clear idea what technological answers we need to these problems. It's really about putting the political will together to get these the different parts of industry and the public and so on working together on these problems.
That was Robin Mills, author of The Myth of the Oil Crisis, Overcoming the Challenges of Depletion, Geopolitics, and Global Warming, just out from Prager. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. Back after this musical interlude. Thank you. That was the Bourrée from Bach's French Suite No. 5, performed in a new recording by Simone Dinnerstein. My next guest is Bracken Hendricks, who is a fellow at the Center for American Progress. He worked in a report jointly produced by his employer and the Political Economy Research Institute, a.k.a. PERI, at the University of Massachusetts. The report is called Green Jobs. You can download it from the PERI website, which is at peri.umass.edu. That's peri.umass.edu. Hendricks is also the co-author of a book called Apollo's Fire, which is about new energy strategies. For more on that, visit apollosfire.net. The U.S. economy faces two major challenges right now. One, the short to medium term one of reversing the recessionary burdens of the credit crunch and the housing slump, and a longer term one of finding forms of energy that won't snuff out life on planet Earth. Of course, that second challenge is one we share with just about everyone else on the planet. The Green Jobs Report is an approach to accomplishing both goals at once. Bracken Hendricks. When economists and politicians talk about the environment, it's often treated as a cost, something in opposition to the imperative of economic growth. You've got a different approach, don't you?
Absolutely. I think you put your finger exactly on the central challenge right now in figuring out how to tackle our global climate crisis, which is how to harness the investment that will need to be made in building climate solutions as an engine to reposition our economy to be more competitive in increasingly global markets, how to train workers and promote access to these emerging fields, emerging industries, and use this as a pathway into prosperity and a pathway out of poverty for literally millions of people. At the Center for American Progress, we just completed a job study. We called it Green Recovery. We worked with the University of Massachusetts to look at what the impact would be from an aggressive program to invest in energy efficiency and renewable energy. And we determined that a program to invest $100 billion over the next 2 years, not quite a stimulus package, which would traditionally be, you know, sent out over less than a year, but a short-term growth package, would create 2 million jobs. And these are jobs in familiar fields. This is, you know, through energy efficiency, you have jobs for insulators, for electricians, swapping out inefficient lighting systems, for testing and balancing air conditioning systems. In solar and wind, there's tremendous amount of manufacturing that's needed to build the turbines and build the concentrated solar power plants that are going to come online in coming years. And that can mean jobs in Michigan, you know, making ball bearings or sheet glass or steel. These are fundamental investments in our economy. We also looked at the impact of investments like transit and freight rail and investing in our grid to make a smart grid that uses modern communications technology to access energy efficiency as a new energy resource. So you don't have to build a new polluting power plant. Instead, you can have a situation where you can actually control appliances remotely to reduce demand at peak load, so you don't have to turn on another boiler. Those are very important investments, and they're investments in the fundamental infrastructure of our economy.
I want to go through all those points in more detail, but before we get that, you mentioned a $100 billion price tag, and that's roughly the same ballpark as the recent stimulus program that sent $600, $1,200 checks to everyone. How does your scheme differ in job creation potential from more conventional stimulus approach of just sending people checks?
Yeah, it's actually very significant. We spent $168 billion sending out checks in the most recent economic stimulus package. What we found in this study was that as a solution to dealing with our oil dependence, and as a solution to dealing with our economic growth, building a green economy, investing in a clean energy, low-carbon economy is actually the best form of economic growth. There were four times more jobs created by investing in a green energy transition than there were by investing in oil. And not only four times the number of jobs, but three times the number of good, high-paying jobs, paying over $16 an hour. The benefits were a little bit greater from a tax-based stimulus, you know, or a rebate where you send checks out to folks. But still, there were, 300,000 more jobs created from green investment than there were created from just stimulating consumption by giving people checks. And it makes sense when you think about it, because instead of giving people money to buy goods from China to increase their consumption, what you're doing is you're investing in local economies. You're investing in saving on people's energy bills. You're giving money to skilled craftsmen to improve the energy efficiency of a building or install a solar panel. This then circulates within the local economy instead of flowing overseas.
This is radio, so we can't get too technical, but when people hear numbers like job creation estimates, they might get kind of skeptical. How did you arrive at these figures?
Sure, and we did fairly traditional analysis. First, we said, what is the work that's embodied in energy efficiency retrofits for homes or in building new transit and rail systems, doing things like creating solar and wind and advanced biofuels that don't use food crops. And we looked at the types of industry sectors that were involved. And then we did, a traditional economic modeling exercise where we said, you're circulating the money into these different sectors of the economy, and what do they need in terms of suppliers, and how does that flow, using a traditional economic model to get the job estimates. A very, I think, reliable, and if anything, a very conservative estimate. And ultimately, though, I think it's right. This is just a modeling exercise, but it underscores a very important point, which is that there are some very basic choices being made about our economic direction, and that looking at the transition to a green economy creates a tremendous opportunity to think about how are we investing in communities to rebuild them? How are we investing in workers to make sure that they have access to good jobs, that they're getting skills and training that they need? And we just started to look at what these policies really mean. And if you track it through, there's a tremendous opportunity to rebuild career ladders that have been fundamentally broken in the U.S. economy. I said we create more good-paying jobs, but we also create more jobs overall through a green growth strategy. And that means we're creating more entry-level jobs. So it's by no means automatic that we will create these career ladders and pathways into the middle class, but we have a tremendous opportunity to invest in construction, to invest in manufacturing, and then to create the sorts of policies for workforce investment and training that for generations were a way to get a good family-supporting wages and benefits and skills that could sustain a real career over a lifetime. And that's really been broken in the globalizing economy over the last several decades. We've seen 800,000 jobs lost in construction. We've seen millions of jobs lost in the manufacturing sector since the Bush administration took over. There's been a 17% decrease in housing values just since last year. What we're saying is that by investing in energy efficiency, by investing in renewable energy, we can drive new access to capital, new public investments that will lead the way for private investment in these very areas that have been so hard hit. And they are so critical for having a prosperity that's broadly shared. We've watched the division between wealth and poverty widen vastly over the last, several administrations. And this is a chance to start to close that gap by rebuilding a middle class, by rebuilding blue-collar jobs, but using the greening of the economy to turn them into green-collar jobs. And think about how workers in construction and manufacturing can actually be part of the solution. And that's very important, not only economically, but it's also important for changing the politics around this issue. You said in your opening that we're too used to thinking of the environment as a cost, and really nothing could be farther from the truth. The president of the United Steelworkers, Leo Gerard, is a great leader on environmental issues, and he does it from the perspective of protecting workers' rights and protecting the communities that they live in. And he's very fond of saying that we can have jobs and a healthy environment, and in fact, we will have both or we'll have neither. And I think that's the fundamental truth that often gets obscured in the debate, is that probably the most costly and regressive path we can follow is to allow a climate crisis to unfold. It's going to hurt workers. It's going to hurt the poorest people on the planet the most brutally. So these green solutions are good in that way from heading off a harm. But the thing that we're trying to really expose in this report and in a whole series of pieces of analysis and work that we're doing is that we stand at a crossroads today. If we take no action, the path of inaction leads directly toward climate crisis. It leads towards 2 billion people going without reliable access to drinking water, hundreds of millions of climate refugees, substantial impacts along the lines of what we saw with Hurricane Katrina, where people will be refugees to a worsening environmental crisis. But just as surely, moving forward is going to require hundreds of billions of dollars of investment. It's going to create new industries. It's going to require reinvesting in the physical infrastructure of our cities and our rural communities, and it's going to create tremendous opportunities to rebuild.
I'm speaking with Bracken Hendricks of the Center for American Progress, who worked on a Green Jobs Report with some people from the UMass Political Economy Research Institute. Bracken, you have several major components to your plan. Let's give a minute or two to each. First, retrofitting buildings. What's involved and what kind of jobs are created?
Sure. Retrofitting buildings is sort of the smartest policy that we could be pursuing right now. The cheapest energy is the energy you don't have to use. The least polluting energy is the fossil fuel you don't have to burn. So retrofitting a building simply means, you know, insulating it. It can be as simple as fixing up your heating and air conditioning system to make sure it's operating efficiently. If you apply it to factories, there's tremendous gains that can be made by swapping out inefficient pumps or fans or blowers or cooling equipment. Really, this is a new source of energy, and it means jobs for electricians and carpenters and construction workers of all types, as well as building inspectors and designers and architects as well, you know, moving up the ladder of training and skill development.
Next, rail. That's pretty capital intensive. What kind of schemes do you have in mind here?
There is a backlog of transit projects that are waiting to be built that could actually be moved into the pipeline very quickly. The basic engineering has been done. Increasing the federal match to those programs for new transit starts or providing assistance with transit systems that are increasingly strained with rising prices of gases as people are moving toward greater use of public transportation that already exists. That's a great way to get money into the economy in a way that reduces our dependence on oil, reduces our dependence on polluting fossil fuels, and stimulates jobs. Actually, the transit investments are one of the biggest job creators here out of all the different strategies we looked at. And it's good common sense. It's good long-term policy, but in the short term, it actually puts money back into the pockets of working people, and it helps save consumers money over time as it makes their commuting easier.
You talked about the smart grid earlier, but could you expand on that? Just what is a smart grid?
The smart grid is a fascinating thing. It sounds almost like, you know, the Jetsons when you talk about it, but it's coming very rapidly. We have basically our electrical grid is a technology that was invented in the 19th century and has basically not changed. And it's designed much like an old mainframe computer. You had one big central power plant in the hub, and you have all these spokes of, you know, power lines radiating out to people who use the energy. It's very inflexible. It can be brought down easily, and it's very inefficient as well. There's a lot of line loss of energy, and what the smart grid actually starts to use the electrical grid as a communications infrastructure so that the utility company and the consumer of energy are actually exchanging information about use through smart digital meters at their homes and things, where they can basically, you can use energy efficiency as a source of new power. At the hottest day of August, right now we have to build our power system to provide, you know, the maximum amount of energy that's needed at these very small price spikes, or these very small spikes in demand. And instead, if we could just manage that demand through smart appliances, through smart metering and real-time pricing that will send different signals to consumers, you could actually build fewer power plants. Consumers could save money, and the utility companies would be reducing their pollution. It gives consumers a lot more choice. Ultimately, as we move to electric vehicles as well and get off oil with these plug-in electric hybrid cars, then your car battery can actually store up power at night when it's off-peak power, and that energy can be used for transportation at two-thirds of the carbon emissions from just burning oil. So it's exciting technology.
And, of course, there are alternative energy sources. First, wind and solar. Are these ready now, or do we have to wait for some technological advances before they become economically competitive with more conventional sources of energy?
Oh, they're extremely viable today. Wind is cost competitive in many parts of the country with natural gas. Natural gas and coal prices are only rising. Appalachian coal has risen 200% in price in the last couple of years. China and India and the globalizing, you know, the growing global markets are demanding very limited supplies of fossil fuels, and it's driving prices up. What renewable energy like solar and wind do is there's no fuel cost. It's just the technological investment, and that's a very stable cost that you can predict over time. These are very workable technologies now. I mentioned a little bit about concentrated solar power a few minutes ago. These are utility-scale power plants. They can generate, you know, very large amounts of electricity, and they do it just simply by focusing the sun's rays with a series of mirrors onto a tube that of fluid that heats up and then drives a turbine. There's no pollution, nothing is burnt, no fuel cost, and it's very efficient, elegant technology. And folks are starting to build that at scale now in a number of places around the country. And these technologies are extremely promising, and the costs can be driven down very significantly as they start to go to scale.
Does solar work only in really sunny areas, or could New York and Seattle benefit from it too?
One of the largest solar markets in the world right now is Germany. They have about the solar exposure of Anchorage, Alaska, I believe. So, you know, it's very significantly less solar exposure than we have in most of the United States. They have grown their solar industry by investing in securing it as a strategic industry. They have set in place policies that it's called a feed-in tariff that gives a guaranteed price for any electricity you can produce. The price goes down over time. It's designed so that there won't be a permanent subsidy, but it's designed to jumpstart that market. So people are rushing to install solar panels in their homes. The bulk of the global market for solar panels is actually flowing into Germany. It's actually it's creating pressure on the supply for solar panels. And then they're also helping build out the manufacturing industries to support that demand. In Germany, they also have very progressive policies on wind, and they now have more people working in the wind industry today than in their entire nuclear industry. So it shows that this can be good sort of mainstream economic and jobs policy for working folk.
You just mentioned nuclear. That's being rebranded in some quarters as a green source of energy. Is that really true?
I recently wrote a book called Apollo's Fire with Congressman Jay Inslee from Washington State, and in it we talk about nuclear power, and we look at it closely, and we feel like that the climate crisis is probably the most severe threat that we're facing at the moment, and anything that can provide low-carbon energy needs to get fair consideration. But when you really look closely at nuclear power, you know, it hasn't been Jane Fonda that has prevented the construction of new nuclear power plants. Wall Street doesn't want to invest in them. And there's a reason, which is that, you know, it's extremely expensive. There's a great deal of risk associated with it. Disposal issues, proliferation issues, and security threats tied to it that really haven't been resolved. And a great deal of money has gone into trying to get that technology mature and to come online. If you were to invest the same amount of sort of public subsidy that we spend on nuclear power in getting solar energy to scale to really drive down the price so that it's fully cost competitive with coal power, if you were to spend that on a massive program to weatherize homes and retrofit buildings at the scale of entire cities, you could access tremendous potential for new energy and for energy savings. And you know, for our money, that's where you should put the first investments.
The last form of alternative energy you write about is biofuels. And I get a little skeptical here. Certainly, they've been driving up food prices recently, and it's not clear that they produce more energy than goes into making them. So what exactly are you talking about?
Well, we're talking here specifically about something called cellulosic biofuels, which are made from the woody plant materials. You can make them out of construction waste. You can make them out of rice hulls, byproducts from the pulp and paper industry, from corn stover. So it dramatically increases the amount of plant matter that can be turned into fuel, and therefore increases both the efficiency and reduces the impact on food crops. You can grow things like switchgrass, which they're not food crops at all. So it's not pulling commodities out of market for, you know, as corn ethanol does, which I think has been shown to be quite problematic. But these advanced biofuels, I think, are very important as a piece of the solution. They're not the entire solution. We need more efficient cars. We certainly need to move to electrical vehicles. The plug-in hybrid electric cars I mentioned before can go 40 miles before they use a single drop of liquid fuel. But once they start using liquid fuel, we should make sure that they're using as little oil as possible. certainly the oil industry is one of the more regressive and destructive industries on the planet, and I would like to see some of that impact reduced by the use of these advanced biofuels that are less environmentally harmful.
Finally, your $100 billion program, how would you go about financing it?
Here we look at a package that includes some tax incentives, some loan guarantees, and some direct spending. We think it's important to actually spend some money on this stuff right now. It's a real investment. It's different from sort of, you know, it's like the kind of investment that you make when you borrow for a mortgage or to put your kid through school. These are long-term investments in economic productivity, and I think they make a great deal of sense. But having said that, there's a lot of money already in the system that's flowing toward waste, that's flowing toward pollution, and we can redirect a great deal of that money. Right now we spend $600 billion, over $500 billion are going to flow out of this country this year just for imported oil. We're spending increasing money on oil and natural gas and coal as these prices spike. So the price of energy, of unsustainable energy that's used inefficiently, is going to rise dramatically. So again, these are investments that will unleash a great deal of cost savings. Over time, though, as we get a cap and trade or some sort of a price put on carbon, that is actually potentially a huge source of revenue. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that between $50 and $300 billion will be produced every year if we auction the permits for carbon emissions. That's money that can be spent to help drive down consumers' bills, to help move these new clean technologies to market, to make our cities more energy efficient, give people transportation choices like transit, like alternative fuels, and cars that don't run on liquid fuels at all. This is the kind of transition we need to be thinking about. It certainly can be funded by simply putting a price on carbon. What we show in this report is that the economic benefits are there, just looked at, you know, on their own merit. This would be a smart place to spend money. Certainly we don't ask for the same sort of rigor when we send young kids into harm's way in Iraq or when we are freeing up $168 billion for a stimulus package that is simply flowing into consumption. Right now they're talking about a second stimulus package. What we're saying is, if you're going to throw money into the economy to create growth, let's be thoughtful about the kind of growth we're trying to create. And let's invest in those areas that are going to help us in this incredible challenge we're going to face about building a clean energy economy, weaning ourselves from expensive and polluting fossil fuels, and creating these new industries that are going to be the engine of the American economy as we move forward into the next century.
That was Bracken Hendricks of the Center for American Progress. You can find out more about his book, Apollo's Fire, at apollosfire.net. And you can download the Green Jobs Report from the website of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts at peri.umass.edu. That's peri.umass.edu. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with some of the musical version of the anti-clerical rant we heard earlier. This is Religion 2 by Public Image Limited from their first record. Bye.